Each week, American History TV sits in on a lecture with one of the nation's college professors. You can watch the classes here every Saturday at 8 p.m. and midnight Eastern, and again Sundays at 1 p.m. This week, architectural historian Barry Lewis looks at architecture in New York City from the late 19th and early 20th century. This 90-minute program took place at Cooper Union in New York City.
All right. Okie doke. How do you do? I'm Barry Lewis, and we're starting the second semester of The City Transformed. The two semesters basically take us on a trip through New York's history, through its architecture and its city planning. The fall semester, we go from colonial days until the 1890s, and this spring semester, we're going to go from the 1890s until today. Now, first we got to make sure we all know what New York is. Most of you are New Yorkers, so of course we do know, but do we? New York begins basically in the 17th century. By 1800, there's just 60,000 people crammed into the southern point of Manhattan Island. Just remember, it was the English that made all of Manhattan contiguous with the borders of New York City. But the city only existed in the lower part of the island, and in 1800 with 60,000 people, once you got to 14th Street, what we call 14th Street, you were in upstate New York. Now, that changes. On the left is a Civil War era print, an aerial view of New York. By the Civil War era, the city has expanded to about 60th Street. Central Park at the top of the slide is being built at the northern edge of the city. That is about 1860, 1868. On the right is an aerial view of the five-borough city in 1910, the area, the era that we're covering today. The era, the 1890s, the 1910s, the 1920s, we turn from a single island city into a five-borough city. 1898, we annex the whole city of Brooklyn, half of Queens County. We have already annexed part of Westchester. We call it the Bronx, and Staten Island as well. Now, here is a city at in 1900, this five-borough city has 3.5 million people. About 1.75 million live in Manhattan. About 1.25 million live in Brooklyn alone. By 1940, we're going to have 8 million people in this city. Now, this means tremendous growth, and it also means that this city is on the verge of becoming a world capital, and we knew it. This era is the era when America is coming of age. We are becoming a world power. We fight the Spanish-American War. We get colonies. Teddy Roosevelt brokers the peace between Russia and Japan. It's the 1900s. Economically, we basically bypass Europe in terms of being the greatest economic power on Earth. You could say it's the beginning of the American century. Now, I don't know if we're at the end of the American century, but I know we're at the beginning in this lecture. I can't tell you about the end. And this era saw the new scale of these world capital cities, and especially New York. We were the capital of the country in every way but political. And we saw a vision for this new city of the coming 20th century in the Chicago World's Fair of 1893, which you're looking at in back of me. Actually, this World's Fair, the Great White City on Lake Michigan, was mostly the product of New York architects. And they had a vision of a great white neoclassical city that we New Yorkers, all Americans, whether you're from Des Moines or Dubuque or New York, you carried back to your city in 1893 this magnificent vision of the city. And considering we were becoming a world-class country, a world power, our main cities, world capitals, this was the vision we would carry for the next 30 years. Now, it coincided with the coming of age of American architects. This is the first era we have professionally trained architects in this country. We always had amateurs, but not anymore. They either go to the École des Beaux-Arts, the academy in Paris, to learn their profession, or to one of the new architectural schools here in the United States. I know a lot of people think the Beaux-Arts, all they did was teach you how to design a bar mitzvah palace, but that is not true. They really gave you a thorough grounding in the professionalism of designing buildings. They taught you how to design a well-planned building, beautifully proportioned rooms, a beautiful flow from room to room. They called it the enfilade, and how to wrap all that in an exterior that spoke to the city around it, something that some modern buildings can use today. And this vision is going to transform the American cities, and especially New York. When the architect come back from that World's Fair in the next 20 years, they totally transform the city. They bring us new buildings on a new scale we have never seen before. We're going to cover these buildings in this lecture, from the Metropolitan Museum on the upper left, the Public Library on the right, multi-entertainment complexes like Madison Square Garden and Carnegie Hall, built only a year later, and headquarters for media companies. No, it's not Microsoft, it's not Apple, it's the New York Herald newspaper at Herald Square. But though it looks like a pretty palazzo, it was a high-tech machine for selling newspapers. And the same generation gave us absolutely amazing transportation complexes, Penn Station on the left, Grand Central on the lower right. Built between 1898 and 1913, these two major transportation complexes, still amazing in their planning. Grand Central, more than just a transportation complex, an entire piece of the city from 42nd Street up Park Avenue to 97th Street was rebuilt in the 1900s, 10s, and 20s under the aegis of the Beaux-Arts designers. And this is also the era that gives us the skyscraper. True, Chicago invented the skyscraper in 1885. We built our first one in 1890. We were scared to death of it. We were afraid it would fall over and crush us. But you notice we adapt. By 1903, this is Broad Street. You can see how high everything's going. Chicago stopped at 20 floors. We kept on going. We're a narrow island. Everybody wants to be here. They all wanted to be at Broadway and Wall. The Woolworth Building opening in 1913, 800 feet tall, 75 stories by modern standards. We are the first skyscraper city in the world when you think about it. So, before we go on, just to make sure we're all on the same page, the Beaux-Arts tradition that these architects were reframing the city in, it goes back to the Italian Renaissance, where in Vicenza, Italy, it's right off of Venice. Vicenza was to the Venetian Empire, think of Venice in the 1400s, 1500s as the New York of the Adriatic. And if you were a merchant, if you were a Donald Trump in the Venice of the 1400s and 1500s, you would have your house outside of Vicenza. That was the East Hampton for Venice in those days. And this is one of the most famous houses to come out of the 16th century, the Villa Rotonda. And this represents, in a sense, a new idea of architecture that's coming of age in Europe in the 15th and 16th century. Basically, the neoclassical system, to put it in a nutshell, was all about perfection. Neoclassical designers said, okay, life is irrational, it's difficult, it's stressful, everybody's driving you crazy, even without iPhones, everybody's still driving you crazy. When you went home for the weekend and you came off the main road and you came off the driveway and you looked at this beautifully harmonious, unified, perfectly balanced building, you felt like you had fallen into heaven. And that was the whole idea. The neoclassicists said you could have heaven on earth. You don't have to die to get there like you had to in the Middle Ages. You could have heaven on earth and you could do it through art. Art, music, sculpture, architecture. And in architecture, Andrea Palladio synthesizes 100 years of Renaissance ideas in the 1560s, 70s, and 80s. He gives us the Villa Rotonda. Basically, it's the template for our McMansions right through the early 21st century. But he is giving us a wonderful program, a harmony, a balance, all of it focused on the portico, the front of a Roman temple. How shrewd to we Americans, when we see a portico, we think Supreme Court, maybe U.S. Capitol, maybe a bank, maybe a theater. They thought in ancient Rome and in the Italian Renaissance, they understood this was where the gods were worshipped. And this was the symbol of the ancient Roman gods. Not bad, an architectural symbol for the nouveau riche of Venice of the 16th century, the Donald Trumps of their day. They came home to a house that really spoke of the ancient Roman gods. But it also was a brilliant plan for creating a beautiful, harmonious, and perfectly balanced house. Here we see the Villa Rotonda from the side. And you can see how that portico and staircase, that element, is put to brilliant effect 500 years later by our Beaux-Arts designers. Palladio, back in the 1560s, used, if you've ever been to a Roman temple, you know you have to go up steps to get to a Roman temple. It kind of humbles you, which was the whole idea. Look what Palladio does. By bringing the guests up the steps to what is really the second floor, we Americans call it the second floor, Europeans call it the first floor, this allows the ground floor to be a full-service floor to service whatever the needs of the house are above. This was not lost on the Beaux-Arts designers of the early 20th century. Now, in the city, the same idea was used. This is a model of the Palazzo Tiene, also by Palladio, never really built. Part of it was built. In the city, you didn't have room for a grand stair. So you came into the house. The ground floor, again, was for services, but also for the business of the man of the house above. Now, you don't have room in a crowded walled city for grand stairs outside. So your guests came into the only part of the ground floor they were interested or ever saw, a beautiful entrance hall that led to a main stair inside that led you up into the piano nobile, the main floor of the house where all the ballrooms were. Again, this was not lost on Beaux-Arts designers of New York in the early 20th century. Jump 500 years, 400 years, and we're at Fifth Avenue, the Metropolitan Museum, under construction in the about 1900. The original Met, you can barely see it on the upper left there, was done in the 1870s and 80s as a rustic, artsy, craftsy kind of a little hut. Well, it really wasn't a little hut. It's kind of like an elephant trying to pretend it's a flea. But it's trying to pretend it's rustic. It's trying to fit into the park with its rustic design. And by the way, it's all there. You just have to look for it. It's all been buried by later buildings. But in 1895, Richard Morris Hunt, the first professionally trained architect to come from New York, go to Paris, and get his education there, he builds a new wing for the Metropolitan Museum that completely reorients the museum to Fifth Avenue. It's no longer a rustic hut in the park. It's a magnificent civic building that graces Fifth Avenue and the Upper East Side, which is, in the 1890s, becoming the new millionaire's district of New York. Basically, Hunt, who had lived in Paris to get his education at the Beaux-Arts, understood the French loved their cities. And they took the Italian neoclassical system and they turned it into a magnificent system for urban buildings to give a kind of urban presence, a kind of monumental presence, a theatrical stage set presence. And that was one of the things that people loved, and they still do, about these Beaux-Arts buildings. Now, I know in between then and now, we had the modern movement, you know, glass, white walls, everything minimalist. But in the end of the 20th century, we kind of resurrected the idea that a building is more than just steel and glass, that a building should have some kind of spirit to it. And the fellow who has probably captured that most is Frank Gehry. In his Guggenheim Bilbao on the left, he's basically using titanium and computer graphics to create the same kind of drama, the same kind of visual interest that the neoclassicists did with their neoclassical idiom back 100 years ago. On the right is the new Beekman Tower that he's just completing there in lower Manhattan. I may not like the scale of Beekman Tower. I may not like the prices that they're going to be charging for Beekman Tower. But, you know, it's New York. It changes. We have to change with it. But I have to admit, whether you like Gehry or you don't like Gehry, he certainly knows how to capture your eye and create a skyline effect. And that was exactly what the neoclassicists did, the Beaux-Arts designers did 100 years ago in the 1900s and 10s. So we go back to the Metropolitan Museum on Fifth Avenue, modeled on the Villa Rotunda and the neoclassical designs that came out of the Renaissance. It's a public building. There are 5 million visitors a year today to the Metropolitan Museum. Imagine if every single one of them had to stand still and say, how do I get in? You ever visit a modern museum? It's all glass. It's minimalist. And all these visitors are coming to it. And the first thing you ask is, where is the front door? Now, I love all the glass. It's wonderful. But it's so minimalist, I'm completely confused. Here are buildings that were absolutely user-friendly. You understood immediately where the entrance was. You never even had to have been in New York. You knew right away. And like the Villa Rotunda, you had to go upstairs to get to the Piano Nobile, the main floor. That left the ground floor, a service floor, very important for a museum, truck entrance, limousine entrance, chauffeured limousine entrance for your wealthy patrons. All that could come through the ground floor. Pedestrians go up onto the second floor. The separation of vehicular traffic from pedestrian traffic, a very 20th century idea. So they're using the grand stair and portico idea of the Villa Rotunda. But when you get inside the building, and of course here again, the triple arched entrance, we know exactly we are, exactly how to get in. It's almost as if they had a neon sign in red with a big arrow saying, enter here. And that's what makes it really friendly to us. It makes it, that's why I've always loved the Met. Years ago in the 1950s when I was a kid, you could go through the Met and there was nobody in the Met. I mean nobody. There was nobody in MoMA either. You had the whole place to yourself. So I kind of felt like it was my home. And so you go up the stairs, you enter the main entrance, and you are led by the architecture directly into the Grand Hall. A huge entrance hall through the colonnade on the left. The entrance from Fifth Avenue is on the right. The colonnade on the left leads to the grand stair up to the second floor galleries. As a kid, when I used to come here, I don't think I remember the paintings, but I do remember the grand stair. I felt like I was in a Hollywood movie. I think many of you are familiar with that stair. What a great way to get to the European paintings. This, to me, is not just an entrance hall. This is a town square of a city within the building, and it leads to skylit indoor boulevards. When you come in from Fifth Avenue on the right, today you have the circular information desk. You get your questions are answered. You get your map. You have coat check is over there. Museum store is over here. Up the stairs is the second floor. On the balcony, sometimes they put tables around the balcony, which is perfect because they're like tables in an outdoor cafe overlooking the central piazza of the Metropolitan Museum, the entrance hall. And that entrance hall leads to magnificent skylit boulevards. We call them corridors. The southern one, the one in the downtown direction, was restored in the last 15 years for the Greek and Roman collection. And we're looking south from the main hall is in back of us, and we're looking towards a smaller piazza, skylit, where we used to go for eating, dining. Remember the cafeteria was there. They restored it, and they put it back to its original use as a gallery for Greek and Roman art. But it's a grand indoor boulevard, a skylit boulevard, taking us from the central piazza. If you look at the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C. from 1940 by John Russell Pope, the same plan that makes it user-friendly. The grand stair takes you up to the second floor. The ground floor is free for vehicular entrance. That staircase leads you directly into the main rotunda, your town square. You get your orientation, check your coat, whatever you need. And then the National Gallery has beautiful indoor skylit boulevards that take you in both directions to smaller piazzettes, if you want to call them that, smaller piazzas that are skylit, landscaped, and where they have indoor concerts. No matter how you do the galleries in the National Gallery of Art, once you fall back into the skylit central circulation system, you know exactly where you are. This is brilliant planning. Now, these ideas, so American, so pragmatic, so practical, very much for a mass society. You know, we built not for the upper 1% or the bottom 99%. We built for the 100%. We built for everybody. And just the same skill that we applied to public buildings, we applied to something new on the entertainment horizon, a multi-use entertainment complex. We're looking at the 1890 Madison Square Garden. This was located at the northeast corner of Madison Square. That is 26th Street. This is Madison Avenue. The building stretched all the way to 4th Avenue. We call it Park Avenue South. It was designed by McKim, Mead & White, and it technically is the second Madison Square Garden. This was the site in the 1850s for Grand Central Depot, 1870s. This was actually the 1850s. It was Grand Central Depot before they moved up to 42nd Street. When Grand Central did move up to 42nd Street, what they left behind was the huge train shed. That train shed was used first by P.T. Barnum for his Hippodrome Theater. Then the Equestrian Society of New York took it over for their upscale horse show. Well, the horses may have been upscale, and the horse riders may have been, the equestrians may have been upscale, but a rusty old train shed is not very upscale. So they decided in the late 1880s to demolish that, and they hired McKim, Mead & White to do this magnificent multi-entertainment complex. The Madison Avenue end of it had several theaters, including a 1,500-seat music hall the size of today's town hall on 43rd Street, a 1,200-seat legit theater for shows, for plays, and that's the equivalent of a large Broadway theater today. It had New York's largest restaurant. Some people say it had a billiards room, which would be very typical of those days. That was a very upscale indoor sport. It had a beautiful arcade at Madison 26th and 27th. So when you alighted from your carriage, your cab, your taxi, your hansom, whatever it was, you were sheltered from the wind, the rain, the sun, whatever was going on out there. And the top of that multi-entertainment complex, behind the colonnades, an outdoor roof garden theater where during the warmer months they could have the midnight frolics. Stanford White, the co-designer of the building, loved this building, hung out there all the time. He was hanging out there in June of 1906 to watch the Floridora girls when Harry K. Thor walked up and shot him dead. Now, you know, his partner, Charles McKim, was a brilliant architect, and so was Stanford White. But Stanford White was killed in a sex scandal, so everybody knows the name of Stanford White. Charles McKim died in bed. We forgot him. But this building not only had this multi-entertainment complex facing Madison, stretching towards 4th Avenue, Park Avenue South, the rest of the building was an 8,000-seat convention center with a retractable roof, by the way. You think that's such a brand new idea of the 20th century. It was the largest enclosed arena in the United States at that time, one of the largest in the world. And between the two halves of the building was the second highest tower in New York City, a 32-story high tower that you could see for miles around. All of this modeled on Spanish Renaissance prototypes from the 16th century. Kim, Mead, and White were brilliant designers, and they really did a gorgeous job of taking the Spanish Renaissance and turning it into a multi-entertainment complex for the modern era. Here, you're looking at Madison Square Garden from Upper Madison Avenue. You can see the arcade that gave you shelter when you came out of the carriage. There is the multi-entertainment complex itself. The colonnades where the rooftop theater was. Here is your entrance on the right. Stanford White was brilliant at decorative effect. What I love about it, it was all set against a Roman brick exterior. Carnegie Hall, which I will get to next, uses Roman brick, long, narrow, beautiful, golden Roman brick. We don't use it anymore because it's so narrow. It requires more courses when you build something, so we don't use it anymore. But if you pay attention, around town, there's some beautiful houses from the 100 years ago, beautiful buildings using that Roman brick. The arena itself, this is Madison Square Garden's 8,000-seat arena. If you filled up the actual arena floor with seats, you probably had about 10 or 11,000 seats. Several political conventions were there. As a matter of fact, the recent series on Prohibition, there was a film clip of the Republican National Convention in 1924, and they had it in Madison Square Garden. And you see them leaving Madison Square Garden, you see the arcades. I was totally thrilled, you know. It doesn't take much to thrill me, but I loved that. Anyway, this, by the way, is an early car show. This is about 1903, 1904, somewhere in there. But it is an early car show when, of course, automobiles were for the rich and no one ever expected them to be anything but a toy for the rich. A beautiful photograph on the left I found on the internet. Here is the piece of the building facing Madison Square, facing Madison Avenue. There is your arena with your little retractable roof, but it's still a retractable roof. And there is your 32-story high tower, at the top of which was a statue that totally scandalized. There it is up there. You can hardly see it, which most of America was just as happy you could hardly see it. The top of the building had a weather vane that was actually a nude statue of Diana, the goddess of the hunt. After all, it was for equestrians, Madison Square Garden. But she was a nude statue that served as a weather vane, and she swiveled, no less, so you could see every detail. And as a result, all the old guys of New York would gather in Madison Square with their binoculars. Nannies would push their kids out of the way when they'd look at the top, and Diana was swinging around, and they'd say, "What is that?" And they were told to kind of be quiet, and they'll find out when they grow up. The rest of the country was absolutely mortified that a naked woman could be seen from all over New York City. The Philadelphia newspaper said, "What do you expect of the depraved taste of New York?" The New York Times shot back that beauty would never be seen as lasciviousness were it not for the Philadelphians. So we got back at them. The irony of that argument, by the way, when this was demolished in the 1920s, where is Diana today? She's in the Philadelphia Museum of Art. At the end of the Benjamin Franklin Parkway, where, by the way, she gets a beautiful sight of honor there at the staircase. Modeled on the Giralda in Seville, which is on the right, but totally adapted to the needs of an almost 20th century entertainment complex. Brilliant, Madison Square Garden. And the other great entertainment complex of the period, William Tuttle's Carnegie Hall, 1891. Carnegie, Andrew Carnegie was really bright when he did this. I did a lecture on Carnegie Hall recently because it's an anniversary. It's an important anniversary this year. Their curator, Gino Francesconi, was really very generous with his information. I know Carnegie Hall from when I was a kid, but it's Carnegie Hall. I don't analyze it. I go there, and I enjoy it. He pointed out why I always loved Carnegie Hall. Tuthill, first of all, Andrew Carnegie wanted to make sure it was not at Madison Square. He saw the handwriting on the wall. He knew Manhattan was moving uptown, and he insisted that his new Carnegie Hall be only at 57th Street or north, not anywhere below. Everybody thought he was crazy. If you were a betting person, you would assume Madison Square Garden would last forever and Carnegie Hall would fold. It was totally the opposite. In fact, the whole city moved uptown to be where Carnegie Hall was built. Tuthill did not have perhaps the elegance of McKim, Mead & White in the exterior design, but he was brilliant in the interior layout of the theater. And again, this Gina Francesconi was pointing out things I've always appreciated but really never was conscious of. This is a very different symphony hall from what you see in Europe. It's very clean, very minimalist, no chandeliers, no heavy curtains, no heavy decoration. By the way, the hall is steel framed so that you don't have heavy columns having to support things above you. It's a steel framed hall, but the steel frame was locked into a brick bearing wall, heavy stone bearing wall on both sides. But the hall itself is steel-framed, and you can see views of it under construction at Carnegie Hall site, at least at the current time. You notice the boxes have no partitions between them, totally unlike European houses. So it's much more physically open, much more democratic. Everybody sees everybody, but it's probably better for the sound as well. And that wonderful stage with that kind of conch shell curving, which cups the sound, the stage, you notice no curtains. No frou-frou, none of that stuff. And it's fascinating how the stage just slightly dips into the audience, all of which seems to work for the marvelous acoustics Carnegie Hall is known for. And besides those two great entertainment complexes, another kind of entertainment was this building on the north end of Herald Square. You would never think you're in Herald Square. This is an 1890s photograph with the 6th Avenue L on the right, which was built in 1879, will come down in the late 1930s. There's Broadway going up to Long Acre Square. You know it as Times Square, but that's still in the future. At the time that in 1893, when the New York Herald built this building, Park Row was the media center of New York and the media center of the United States. There was no Hollywood in those days. Obviously, there were no films. The medium was the newspaper, and they were all on Park Row. And that was the media center of its time. The Bennetts, who ran the New York Herald, had the better idea of breaking away from Park Row, building a new building in the middle of the theater district of the 1890s, Herald Square, you can see by the signs, and basically have the square renamed for the newspaper. That gave the New York Times the same idea 10 years later. They moved up to Long Acre Square. The rest is history. Obviously, it was renamed Times Square for that newspaper. The Bennetts had McKim, Mead & White design a beautiful palazzo, not a skyscraper. So this is kind of conspicuous consumption, all this expensive real estate, and it's just a two-story building. They only had enough space for the New York Herald newspaper offices on the upper floor, and the lower floor was the printing plant of the New York Herald. Here is another view of it. On the left of later view, you can tell it's later because here you have cars, you have motorized vehicles coming up and down Broadway. In the distance, you can barely see it. The new New York Times Tower rises on the newly renamed Times Square. By the time that the tower was built on Times Square, that's 1904, Herald Square had faded as the theater district, and Macy's opens up in 1904, heralding its role, Herald Square, as a new middle-class shopping district. The way that the theater district moved is so New York. Back in the 1860s, 70s, it was Union Square. On the upper right was the theater district. By the 1880s, it's Madison Square, which is why Madison Square Garden was built where it was. By the 1890s, Herald Square. By the 1900s, Times Square. Now, in a few weeks, we're going to take a look at Times Square and the other great theater district, Coney Island. But it's amazing how fast all of this was changing. Every 10, 15 years, the whole city rearranged itself just like it does today. As for the New York Herald building, a beautiful Italian Renaissance palazzo, but a machine for selling newspapers. How's that? What you see as black here on the ground floor were huge plate glass windows. Inside was the printing plant for the New York Herald, which was a two-story high printing plant. The lower story is below the ground, and the second story at street level is the upper part of the printing plant. After the theater was over, you'd come out of the theater. This was ablaze with electric light. Most people went home to gas lighting. It was ablaze with electric light. You stepped up the steps onto a wonderful terrace, a veranda terrace. You looked through the plate glass windows, and you watched them printing tomorrow's New York Herald. They had turned a gritty industrial process basically into entertainment, which is very post-industrial, very 21st century. And then, while you're watching them printing the newspaper, a newspaper kid is running up to you, and there he's shoving the New York Herald in your face and telling you to buy it. And you better buy it. It's New York. So you buy it. You notice the building had, facing Herald Square, very typical of their marketing acumen, a clock. People didn't have wristwatches. Only the rich could have a private timepiece. Your own weather channel, a barometer. Not that I know how to read barometers, but there it is. And at the very top of the building, Stuff and Gruff, they would bang out the hours every hour. So it was a little bit of entertainment. People would gather to look at them and hear them. Mid-1920s, the building comes down. All that is left is Stuff and Gruff. They're in the middle of Herald Square. And you know Herald Square. It used to look, I always say, it used to look like a Jackson Pollock painting, but done by pigeons. Now they've redone Herald Square, and it's beautiful what they've done. Cafe tables, gardens, a little kiosk, and there in the middle of it is Stuff and Gruff. So this was really a newspaper office as an entertainment complex to help sell newspapers. And while the theater district is evolving over on Broadway and up towards Times Square, on Fifth Avenue, a new upscale shopping district is going up from 34th Street up to 42nd and beyond, going up to 57th. This is the 1900s. And in the middle of that upscale shopping district, one of the finest buildings in the city ever, one of the finest institutions, the New York Public Library, opens in 1911. I grew up in this building. I love this building. I was always proud of the fact that anybody can walk into the New York Public Library, of course. They do not even ask you for ID. They never did. They don't today. They may look at your bag, your purse, whatever, but they do not ask you for ID. In the middle of the 1960s, I lived in Paris for 2 years. I was going there to study at the Sorbonne, architectural history. I went into a French public library, and I was going to get a book. And the first thing the librarian said, "Where's your ID?" And I looked at her. I said, "An ID? What do I need an ID for? Isn't this a democracy?" She said, "It's a democracy as long as you have an ID." So, you know, that's very French. There's no ID needed in the New York Public Library. And just like the other public buildings of that generation, a big friendly building that told you where to enter, pulled back from Fifth Avenue for a beautiful terrace. The only free place to sit down on Fifth Avenue until Rockefeller Center was built in the 1930s. A very Beaux-Arts idea, a very civil idea, a very civilized idea. And then we enter the great steps. Again, we're taking up the steps. The ground floor is completely free for services. The truck entrance and limousine entrance used to be on 40th Street. Remember, on the southern end is 40th Street, on the northern end is 42nd Street, and in back of it is Bryant Park, stretching to 6th Avenue. Here we can see, of course, the library being generated from the Italian Palazzo mode. And looking at your maps of the library itself, this is the ground floor. We come up the steps from Fifth Avenue. We enter Astor Hall, named for Brooke Astor, who did wonderful things for the city, especially in the 1970s when everybody was running away from New York. It's hard to really remember, but you know, in the 1970s, the going wisdom was that by 2000, New York would be a ghost town. These are some very pricey ghosts that we have around here today. But in the middle of all that misery in the 1970s, Brooke Astor kept on having faith in the city. So I really have to thank her for that. And so does the library. This is the town square of the library, Astor Hall. It intersects the main boulevard that runs from 42nd Street to 40th Street. Cross that boulevard, that's all outlined in yellow. There are two light courts in the library. You think it's a solid building? No. Two huge light courts bring light pouring into the middle of the building. Beyond the main boulevard and the entrance hall, the town square, Gutzman Exhibition Hall, the library is not only for research. It has a huge collection. It has manuscripts. It has rare books. It has art. So it also has to have exhibitions. That is a wonderful exhibition hall with light, indirect light pouring in because of the light courts on either side. Go up to the third floor. You're now on the third floor of the library. The McGraw Rotunda serves the third floor like the Astor Court serves the first floor. It's the town square of the third floor. To the east of it is the Solomon Room, the other exhibition hall, right behind the cornice. If you look at the photo on the upper right, what you think is a blind cornice at the top of the building you think is dead space, this is America. There's no dead space in a building. You've got to pay for yourself. So behind that cornice, a beautiful exhibition room with north-facing skylights. So it's beautifully lit with indirect lighting. If you go west from the McGraw Rotunda, where the Gutzman exhibition is on the ground floor, is the public catalog room, the Bill Blass catalog room, flooded with light because of the light courts on either side. That leads us to one of the magnificent spaces of that era and any era, the New York Public Library's reading room, a beautiful space where I spent many a time when I was a kid going to high school. Two city blocks long. It could have been overbearing. It could have been looked like a bowling alley. It could have looked like a lot of things, but instead it's a beautiful space, one of the great interior spaces of the city. Again, no ID needed. You go in, you leave, they check your bag, but no ID is needed. Flooded with light. The windows on the right feed from the light, courts. The windows on the left, the light from Bryant Park. You always have a beautiful light-filled room, and the central wooden pavilion is where you get your books. And the pneumatic tube system they installed in 1911 to retrieve your books from the Stax collection they were still using in the early 2000s. If they changed over to a computer system, you know you'd still be there waiting for your books. But with the pneumatic tube system, in 10 minutes, they had your book. Just the whole thing is between the aesthetics, between the high-tech machinery, the light that fills up the room, brilliant piece of work. And then in the Northern Light Court, entered from 42nd Street, if you see the red arrow, you know when you enter from 42nd Street, you could enter the glass skylit single floor circulating library. Today, the circulating library is over at Mid-Manhattan, across Fifth Avenue at 40th Street. And that space is used at the Bartus Forum, the main speaking venue for the library. A beautiful high-tech metallic neoclassicism fills in the Northern Light Court. And because of the planning, you can enter from 42nd Street. This allows the rest of the building to close down while the Bartus Forum parties till midnight or whenever. So it's almost like a building within a building. Brilliant practical planning. Now, the back of the library from Bryant Park, the vertical strip windows delineate the stacks. Above that, the round arch windows, the reading room. Many people consider the elevation, the vertical strip windows, looking forward to the Art Deco of the 1920s. And by the way, before the stock market crash of 2008, the library announced that they didn't need the stacks anymore. They were going to gut the stacks, the original stacks, and take the Mid-Manhattan Library and put them into the Stax area. Now, they still might be doing that. Of course, the economy is different. Why don't they need the Stax in the original building? They have hollowed under Bryant Park. All of their Stax are now under Bryant Park. So, an extraordinary building and totally adapted to 21st century technology. Now, it goes up in the middle of this silk stocking shopping district that is emerging after 1900 on Fifth Avenue. This is Fifth Avenue. We're looking north. That's 34th Street. The steel frame of B. Altman's department store. Now the New York Public Library Business Library. The steel frame of the New York of B. Altman's is going up. Already you have Knickerbocker Bank on the northwest corner of 34th and 5th. You already have Gorham's. We'll see in a moment. You already have Tiffany's at 37th. We'll see that in a moment. At the corner, predating all that by about 10 years, at the corner, the southwest corner of 34th and 5th, where the Empire State Building is today, back in the 1890s, up went the Waldorf Astoria Hotel. The story behind the Waldorf Astoria, and again, I don't want to take too much time, but you know, family is family. It doesn't matter how much money you have. Here on the upper left is a view from the Civil War era, about the 1870s, of Fifth Avenue. The huge building, the huge mansion, is the Stewart House. But across 34th Street are the the twin separated mansions of the Astor family. They share a garden, a walled garden, and the house at the corner of 34th and 5th, sorry, the house at the corner of 34th and 5th was Caroline Schermerhorn Astor's house, William B. Astor's house. She was the Duchess of New York. She's the lady with the ballroom that only held 400 people. She said, well, there are only 400 people worth knowing. Well, she ran society, well, you've been watching Downton Abbey. I mean, you see how a dowager duchess runs society. And she was running New York society that way. In the early 1890s, her husband dies. Her nephew had inherited his father's house on 33rd Street, and he asked his aunt to step aside for his own wife to run New York society. You did not ask Caroline Schermerhorn Astor to step aside. She said no. He got even with her. He moved his family to England, and he built the Waldorf Hotel on the site of his house to spite his aunt, so every time she came home, she had to deal with the hotel. She said, well, it's 1892. This neighbor has had it anyway. I'm moving uptown. That's where everybody's going. She builds a new mansion at 5th and 65th, and she takes her building down, and she builds the Astoria Hotel. So the Waldorf and the Astoria were physically joined, but they are two separate hotels, which is why when you write Waldorf Astoria, it's an equal sign between Waldorf and Astoria and not a dash. By the way, apparently the contract that built this building and joined it to the original Waldorf basically said if the nephew ever bothered Caroline Schermerhorn Astor again, she would wall up the accesses between the Waldorf and the Astoria. The Waldorf Astoria was one of the first grand hotels of the coming 20th century. When you went inside, there was a beautiful, I don't know what happened here. When you went inside, there was a beautiful a pathway, a concourse. We know it as Peacock Alley. And it kind of shows us the shift of entertainment from the houses of the wealthy of New York to public venues. Back in the 19th century, if you wanted to impress people, you had them over to your house and you did a grand spread. But nobody could have a house as grand as the Waldorf Astoria, and that was the whole point. And gradually, society is shifting over their entertainment to these great public venues, these great public hotels. This comes down in 1930 to make way for the Empire State Building and reopens, of course, at Park Avenue and 50th Street, where it still is today. Now, the stores themselves, B. Altman, if you remember, some of you may remember B. Altman, it was one of my favorite department stores. That goes up at 5th Avenue and 34th Street. Steel framed skyscraper, but it's made to look like a Renaissance palazzo. I think a better view of that would be Gorham's, which went up at 36th Street. Here it is, still standing today, not with Gorham's in it, but it's still there today, 5th Avenue and 36th Street. A Renaissance palazzo, a Florentine or Roman Renaissance palazzo, adapted for a specialty jewelry shop of the early 20th century. Beautiful use of glass. The upper part of the building is two or three stories of vertical strip windows. The balconies give you a feeling Juliet's going to come out, or one of the Gucci's are going to come out, you know, and say hello or goodbye to you. Meanwhile, the lower part of the building is 30 feet of glass. Amazing glass shop fronts, a huge ground floor, high ceiling ground floor, a selling floor, a mezzanine floor, lit beautifully with glass. Here's a close-up of that ground floor. Here we go. And you notice that here are two fellows just hanging out, schmoozing away. Look at the height of that glass. You probably could not get more glass on a Fifth Avenue storefront today. But this was done to kind of buy into the illusion of this building being a Venetian Renaissance palazzo, an Italian palazzo. But the building a block away at 5th Avenue and 37th, which is one of my favorite buildings in the city, Tiffany's of 1906, at 5th Avenue and 37th Street, the Morgan Library is just down the block. I love this building because at 11 stories high, it's basically a huge glass box of 100 years ago. It's steel framed, but it's wrapped in an exterior facade, a curtain wall, that makes it look like a Venetian Renaissance palazzo, like you see on the upper right. The amount of glass is amazing at night, especially this time of year. It's winter. Of course, the sun goes down early. They throw the lights on around 4:30. And when they do, you realize it's a wonderful crystalline glass box. With a tissue paper covering, the tissue paper sketched to look like a three-story high Venetian Renaissance palazzo. The upper part of the building, the cornice, you'd think it's a dead space. No way. Lewis Comfort Tiffany was the son of Charles Tiffany who built this. That upper floor is a skylit gallery, a beautiful skylit gallery. This building, again, why did they go through all of this effort to make it look like a palazzo? Well, those of you of my age, you understand, but anyone who's younger, you don't. Back in the 1900s, and certainly in the 1950s when I was a kid, you dressed to go on Fifth Avenue. I know anyone under, 40 or 50 is kind of looking me blankly, but you dressed. And women were expected to wear a dress or a suit. If they were wearing a skirt and a blouse, they thought you were a clerk or you belonged in the stock room. And a man was expected to wear a suit and a tie. If you wore a sport jacket and slacks, they thought you just came in from the country and you didn't have time to change. So you were expected to dress. This shopping was an upscale activity. You were expected to dress the part, and when you went inside, you paid upscale prices for the upscale items these department stores sold. It is a far cry from going to BJ's or Costco for 1,000 rolls of toilet tissue at whatever discount price. That is a whole different atmosphere. And why do you think BJ's, Costco, and all these big box stores make themselves look like warehouses so you feel you're getting a bargain, and yes, you are, but you feel that you're not paying for the chandeliers and the flock wallpaper and all of the display cases, but you did when you walked into Tiffany's. And the upscale illusion that they wanted to give you went hand in hand with the whole activity of shopping. It was just, it was a whole different world back then, and I grew up in it in the 1950s. By the way, if you compare Tiffany's from 1906 with Lieberhaus on the right, from 1954, which one really has more operable glass? And if you stop to think about it, Tiffany's, if you look at Lieberhaus, all of the opaque bands of glass, the dark bands of glass are all opaque, they're all solid, they might as well be stone. And if you think about it, Tiffany's probably has more real window glass and is more of a glass box than Lieberhaus from 1954. Look at it in the early evening when they light it up in the early winter sunsets, a beautiful building for selling upscale merchandise with an upscale feeling. Now, the idea of the department store wrapped to look like a European palace, an Italian palace, it stays with us right through the 1920s. Saks Fifth Avenue opens in 1924. Looks like a European palace if you stop to think about it. By the way, when it opened in the 1920s, 1924 is when it opened, and when it opened, people thought it was so far uptown, nobody would go to it. We know, of course, things worked out differently because New York is always changing. And by the 1930s, 1940s, the whole center of the upscale shopping district had moved up to 57th Street. Well, the era also produced brilliant transportation complexes, the airports of their day, the railroad stations, Penn Station on the west side, 7th Avenue between 33rd Street and 31st Street. It's still there today. Unfortunately, the top of it was taken off in the 1960s. The top of it was demolished, one of the most famous demolitions in New York's history. A magnificent transportation complex, a fascinating story. I'm trying to think of Jill Johns, her nonfiction work on Penn Station. I think it was called Conquering Gotham. Wonderful story on how this got built. Lorraine Deal, the late great Pennsylvania station. A wonderful story, worth telling. I could spend an hour on it itself. On 7th Avenue, in the middle of the Schmatter District, was this elegant entranceway with a central portico for pedestrians to enter a shopping concourse that took you to the waiting room. You'll see all that in a moment. The end porticos were for taxis and cars, brought you down ramps, so when you arrived at the middle of the block, you were one level below the street at the level of the great waiting room on the way to the train concourses that faced 8th Avenue. It's still laid out the same today. It's just not very elegant, but it's still laid out that way today. Now, this all was part of a transportation complex that was both long distance. It necessitated the building of the Hell Gate Bridge. So the Pennsylvania Railroad had, from New York, access to New England. But it also became the nexus of an electric commuter system, the Long Island Railroad to the east, Jersey Transit to the west, that allowed the white middle class to leave New York in the 1910s and 20s and move to the suburbs, whether it was Montclair, New Jersey, or Great Neck. They were getting away from my grandparents who were moving into, they came from Russia, and the old middle class of New York got up and left. And these electric railroad commuter systems allowed them to do it because in 20 minutes, you could be from 7th Avenue and 33rd, you could be in some deep part of Jersey or the North Shore of Long Island. And the whole city is going to change in the next 20 years. Now, if we look at the plan of Penn Station on the left, 7th Avenue is below. There is your pedestrian entrance. That's the middle portico between 33rd, actually it's the equivalent of 32nd Street. And you enter a wonderful shopping concourse, beautifully lit by sunlight, because there are light courts on both sides that go down to the railroad tracks three stories below. You get to a beautiful, there's a beautiful veranda, a balcony overlooking the concourse, which we'll get to in a moment. You had your cheap, quick food on the right. You had your expensive tablecloth restaurant on the left. You went down the steps into this magnificent waiting room that is parallel with 7th and 8th Avenue. And then when your train was called, you went to the train concourse, which I've outlined in blue, because it was all sky lit. If you're coming by foot from 33rd or 31st Street, you would enter in the middle of the block. You can see a portico there in the middle of the elevation. And you would walk over a pedestrian bridge with cars and taxis underneath you, enter a balcony overlooking the concourse, the waiting room, then come down a grand stair, and you were in the waiting room as well. So it was brilliantly thought through. Here is what it looked like. This is a 1911 sketch of the shopping concourse leading to the waiting room. 7th Avenue is in back of us. The waiting room is in front of us. Light pours in through the clerestory windows. Look at those shop fronts. There's a person. That's all glass. That's 30 feet. Looks like 30 feet of glass with the thinnest of neoclassical mullions holding them in place. Again, this was all about light and glass, even though the illusion was monumentalism and stone. And we go down to that concourse. Here is the grand stair leading from the shopping concourse into the waiting room. And the waiting room itself, it is designed as a stage set. It's all steel framing. But it's designed as a stage set to represent the Baths of Caracalla, probably one of the largest such public rooms. I'm not talking about religious church architecture. But it was probably one of the largest such secular rooms that have been created since the Roman Empire. The Romans had reinforced concrete. We had steel framing. A magnificent entry to the city, a magnificent exit from the city, yet it also included where to eat, where to shop, where to get tickets, where to hang out, benches to sit on. And by the way, you're looking at the 33rd Street entrance. You've come over the pedestrian bridge from 33rd Street. Your taxis, your cars have dropped off their people down here. Everybody comes down to the waiting room. Remember, the trains are three stories below, and they're trying to get you three stories down to the trains. Now, it was modeled on the Baths of Caracalla. Here is, on the left, again, the waiting room at Penn Station. On the right, the ruins of the Baths of Caracalla in Rome. You notice how high people are. These ruins, these are wonderful things to visit. When you go to Rome, you should visit the ruins of ancient Rome first and understand the gigantism of the late Roman Empire, and then go to St. Peter's, and then you'll really get St. Peter's. But the architects who designed Penn Station visited Rome while they were studying in Paris. They knew these ruins firsthand. They understood the scale of the ancient world. They translated it into 20th century steel frame construction, giving us a stage set that was a magnificent entry and exit of the city. Yet, when you went to catch your train and you went through the arched opening on the left, you entered a totally high-tech glass and metal train shed. It was all glass, all metal, no decoration except for a clock, because you're not hanging out here, you're running to get your train, and you need to see. The trains are another level below, or two levels. You need as much light as possible. So Pennsylvania Station had, basically, it had the Baths of Caracalla, where that was appropriate, but it also had this magnificent functionalist, absolutely structuralist, minimalist train concourse, because if that's what was needed, they were ready to provide it. These Beaux-Arts trained architects, they were American. So they took that Beaux-Arts training, that 400-year-old tradition, and they applied it to the practical needs of a mass society and to the high-tech technology that we were coming up with in the early 20th century. Penn Station, and as a result, oh, here it is being demolished. And as a result of this demolition, you know, this is why the Landmarks Commission was set up, so that this kind of thing would never happen again. And it's ironic that their competitor across town, Grand Central, the New York Central Railroad, the Landmark Commission had its biggest test over whether Grand Central could be landmarked, and of course, the Landmark Commission won. The original Grand Central of 1871, this is what it looked like. It was fine for 1871. North of it, stretching from 42nd to 50th Street, well, basically about 44th to 50th Street, smoky, dirty, smelly, cinder-filled railroad yard. I mean, really was an awful smoky mess. Nobody cared, because in 1871, few people lived north of 42nd Street. By the 1900s, that was not the case. Most people are living north of 42nd Street, and this had to go. And with a train accident in 1903, it definitely had to go. Well, in place of this smoky railroad yard, William Wilgus, the New York Central engineer in 1903, look what he does. From the same viewpoint, he creates in 1903 a sketch in which he foresees steel framing the railroad yard, double decking it, sinking it below the street level of the city, and for the first time since 1870, extending the crosstown streets across the railroad yard, extending Park Avenue, creating a highway that would run around Grand Central Terminal itself. And William Wilgus realized by electrifying all of the train operations, he could build buildings over the train yards. So he is creating the concept of air rights over 100 years ago. And there's only one place you need air rights, and that's in New York, because there's only one place where you'd want to build on something that's already there to begin with. And this incredible vision is all done. You realize the traffic that he sketches in 1903? It's all horses and carriages. There's no cars yet. We're going from the Middle Ages to the 20th and 21st century. Now, here it is being constructed in 1909 on the left. In 1909, the head house, as we know it as Grand Central Terminal, is going up on the right. You can see the steel framing of the railroad yard. All of that is there, just buried underneath the streets. We don't even know it's there, actually. Here is Grand Central Terminal, finished in 1913. They haven't built the viaduct for the highway yet, but they included a highway around the building. You're not even aware of it. The neoclassical balustrade, the storefronts underneath, camouflage the highway. You don't even know cars are speeding around over your head, totally oblivious to that. The facade with its huge windows is a very simple, single monumental facade. In back of it, a very complicated building. But you don't need to know those complications. The simplicity, the magnificence of the neoclassical facade makes it a real landmark in the city. You come up Park Avenue South, and it's lit up at night, and you can only be in New York City. And yet, behind that very simple monumental facade, what a complicated piece of real estate development this is. Here you see, there you see the highway. I'm sure you know of it if you drive around the city, you take cabs. You're walking on 42nd Street, you don't even know that highway exists. Behind the actual facade, here is another cross-section where you get a better idea. Look at that. There on the right is the south facade of Grand Central, where you see on the upper right. Immediately in back of it, you notice the 75-foot high windows. Two-thirds of the window is devoted to the waiting room. They call it the Vanderbilt Hall. It's where the Christmas market is. Above it is a barrel-vaulted space for the rest of the windows, where the New York Central executives had their office space. And the cornice, in back of the cornice, north-facing skylights lit up the Grand Central Art Gallery, today the Metro North Control Center for the commuter train system. You notice the concourse building. The concourse is in a separate building from the waiting room, and there's a five-story back office building separate from the concourse building. Three separate buildings, but one frontage. Light courts between the three buildings. Light comes through clerestory windows into the concourse. The concourse is in the bed of 43rd Street, so the east and west windows will never be darkened by buildings blocking them. Brilliant. When you're at the clock in the middle of the concourse, you're exactly at Park Avenue and 43rd Street. brilliant, brilliant planning. And by the way, to get you down to the trains, the concourse is one level below the streets, ramps, which makes it handicap accessible today. They were thinking about luggage, but it's a brilliant plan. Reed and Stem, Warren and Wetmore were the architects, and they did a brilliant job. And when you look at the concourse, and no matter how you go into this concourse, no matter how you enter it, it always looks perfect. Why? This concourse, in spite of the fact it's in the middle of this high-tech transportation complex, a whole piece of New York being redeveloped in about 20 years, the heart of this development, this concourse, is a neoclassical double cube. It's the same proportioning as the Banqueting House by Inigo Jones in London from 1620. You go to London, everyone's lined up for Big Ben. Forget Big Ben, it's only a clock. About a few blocks away, you've got the Banqueting House by Inigo Jones. Exquisite, nobody's in there. And you have the whole place to yourself. And it's a beautiful space. It's a double cube. What the neoclassical architects felt was the perfect interior proportions for a great room. That is also true, by the way, of Grand Central's concourse as well. Also, the corners, which you think are dead space, they're little office buildings, and they are connected to each other by glass sidewalks that run through the windows. So, I mean, years ago, before 9/11, everything was left open. You could go up there, open a door, and you could go running back and forth in the windows. It was fabulous. It was kind of futuristic. I grew up with Captain Video. I don't know what you guys grew up with, but I grew up with Captain Video, so I always felt very Captain Video-ish. By the way, all that stonework that you think is very fancy French Ken stone, here's an old 1980s view of the concourse. What a mess. Remember the Kodak sign? Remember they blacked out the eastern windows? Not anymore. Well, all that French Ken stone? No, that's plasterboard from 1913. The steelwork goes through it, goes to the top. You think that's a stone barrel vault the constellations are painted on? Nope, that's an inch of plaster. It is hung from the true roof of the concourse, which is this. This is your steel framing, and below it, the curved floor is actually the roof of the concourse. And you notice the netting? Because, you know, back before the recent renovation, the constellations on the ceiling were lit up by light bulbs. As you can see, they're littered all over the place. And the only way you can change the light bulbs was from these boardwalks that run throughout that ceiling area. And the workers had to reach out with a bulb changer. Because if you stepped onto what you think is the floor, it's only an inch of plaster, you go right through it. Right down to the floor, which is about 150, 130 feet below. The reason they put the netting, many a new maintenance worker at Grand Central didn't know that and would go to step off the boardwalk to go change the bulb and get grabbed, luckily. So they put in the netting to make sure nobody walked on that inch of plaster. By the way, let me see if I can go back. The constellations are backwards. It was a mistake. They realized it a few months after it opened. You know, can you imagine billions of dollars? And all of a sudden you realize, oh my God, the constellations are backwards. So what did they do? They hired a PR person, and he or she came up with a brilliant idea. This is not backwards. This is the constellations according to medieval manuscripts, so that we are seeing the constellations from God's point of view, not man's point of view. And this is what I like about Yanks. You know, no matter what we do wrong, we can always find a PR way out of it. So, brilliant concourse, and really one of the great rooms, interior spaces of New York, which brings up the subject that this Beaux-Arts period gave us some of the grandest interior spaces of the city. Grand Central's concourse on the left, the library's reading room on the right, the Great Hall of the Metropolitan on the lower right, and what is now gone, Pennsylvania Station's waiting room. These great interior spaces, really, we haven't had them since. If they ever build Santiago Calatrava's transit center, if they actually build it, it will probably be the first great interior space, probably, really, since this era. The Art Deco gave us corporate spaces, and postmodernism gave us atriums. But we never had grand spaces like this after the Beaux-Arts era. So we didn't have it before. We haven't had it since. It was an amazing era, but Grand Central is not just a transportation complex. The entire train yard, that's 42nd Street below. Vanderbilt Avenue is here. Lexington is over there. We're looking north towards the top of the slide. All of that train yard was covered over. By the way, William Wilgus could never, ever imagine in 1903 that by the late 1920s, Grand Central would be the nexus of a new corporate headquarters district. The New Wall Street is what they called East 42nd Street in the late 1920s, but they fit in beautifully to William Wilgus's 1903 layout. By the way, Grand Central acts as a low-rise light court for the huge skyscrapers around it. The five-story back office building in back of it was ripped out in the 1960s for the Pan Am building, now MetLife. And the idea was to rip out this building and build a second MetLife. So you'd have two MetLife buildings going up, and that would really be quite beautiful. So that was what the fight was over. Of course, the New York Central, what was left of the New York Central lost, and the Landmarks Commission won, which is why we have Grand Central to this day. Buyer Belinda Bell did a beautiful redo of this a few years ago. Now, like I said, this is not just a transportation complex. All of Park Avenue was redeveloped. The smoky trains are gone, electrified, they're underground. A beautiful park, a linear park is laid over them. By the 1910s and 20s, luxury apartment houses rise on Park Avenue, and a whole new luxury apartment house district all the way to 97th Street is redeveloped. And here is a 1920s view of Park Avenue and the original linear park that was built in the middle of Park Avenue. There are cars, but there's only two little roadways on both sides. This was a beautiful linear park. There's St. Bart's, so you know you're around 50th Street. Look at the brickwork, the lawns, the benches. Beautiful. Well, beautiful doesn't count for much in New York. It lasted 10 years. They ripped it out so they could have more room for cars. If we turn around and we look south, 230 Park Avenue, originally built for the New York Central headquarters. Then it was known as the Helmsley Building. Now it's 230 Park. A very neoclassical, very Beaux-Arts building. Its setbacks match the cornices of the Park Avenue buildings. But look at this. It straddles the Park Avenue highway. It straddles a highway. It's totally futuristic. I mean, it's amazing. How many buildings do you know have a highway running through the bottom of them? And this was completed in 1929, by the way. All these buildings except this one came down by the 1950s for corporate headquarters. You all know Park Avenue is one of the best corporate addresses there is. However, all of the buildings from Grand Central to the Waldorf around 50th Street, you go into them. Thousands of people go into them every day. You go up an escalator to get to the elevator. And of course you have to because there's no basement. All buildings, elevators need an entire floor underneath them for the machinery. These buildings have no basement. There's a train yard underneath. And how do you know there's a train yard? You have expansion joints in the roadways and in the sidewalks because you're not on terra firma. You're on a concrete deck over the railroad yard. So all these people are going up escalators to get to the elevator. And I mean, kind of inefficient, isn't it? But you have to do that because you're on the air rights over a railroad yard. Really is a brilliant idea. And of course, by the 1920s, it becomes the center of a skyscraper district. Here is 230 Park, and there is the Waldorf. Gives you an idea of the extent of the railroad yard, basically from Lex to Madison, from about 46th Street or so, all the way up to 50th. Really is an amazing idea, very American. The way we took neoclassicism from the Renaissance and we adapted it beautifully to the 20th century, the same thing is true of the skyscraper. Here is the Flatiron Building going up in 1903. It was not the first and it was not the tallest. Everybody says that, but it's not. But it was beautiful and everybody loved to photograph it. You're looking, of course, we see this all the time, steel frame skyscrapers, but stop and think, what is the technology? Basically, back in the 1890s when they were introduced, they were explained as a railroad bridge on its end. Because how else do you explain this? Most people were afraid of this thing, and as a matter of fact, you might think we were all loving it. I mean, we love innovation, we're New York, we're Americans, but actually this thing looked a little scary. The poor guy who had this building was not too happy. He couldn't rent it out, he couldn't sell it, nobody wanted to be in this building because they figured any moment the Flatiron Building is going to topple over onto it. Now you notice the curtain wall construction. Once you build a building with a steel frame, you don't need a bearing wall. The exterior is nothing but a skin. The original steel frame buildings of the 1880s, early 90s, the skin had to hold itself up. But that is a lot of weight when you get up to 20, 30 stories. So by the middle of the 1890s, they came up with curtain wall construction, which means every level, you notice at the very top on the right, you can see the steel framing. Every level, the exterior skin or facade is hung from the steel frame like curtains from a curtain rod. Once it's finished, all of those curtains meld together visually, and you think you have a solid building. A lot of people think the Flatiron Building is a bearing wall building and it's all granite. No, it's not. It's terracotta skin. So it's a steel frame building. And you can see the curtain wall is being applied to the flat iron right in the middle of the building with nothing underneath it because it doesn't need anything underneath it. It's being hung from the upper level of the steel horizontal framing, just like a curtain from a curtain rod. So the question is, how do you deal with this new kind of high-rise building? One of the first high-rise districts besides Wall Street was the media center of the city, Park Row. By the way, Park Row went through an amazing history. Here we see, and I showed you this in the last semester, on the upper left, Park Row in 1765, with the brick Presbyterian church between it and Nassau Street, brand new. By the way, St. Paul's is just to the right of it. Now, in the middle slide, brick Presbyterian is gone. It's the 1850s, and that's the New York Times building, brand new in the 1850s. And that has become Printing House Square, the media center of the United States. Fast forward to the 1880s and 90s with the coming of the elevator, the New York Times knocks its building down. This is the second New York Times building. Today it's Pace University. It is there, but it's part of Pace. Next to it is the Tribune with the clock tower ripped out in the 1960s for Pace. And here is Joseph Pulitzer's New York World Building. He of the Pulitzer Prize. It too was famous with its gold dome, destroyed in the 1960s for an interchange between the Brooklyn Bridge and the FDR Drive. These are all elevator buildings, but they have bearing walls. The steel frame skyscraper comes along, and boy, we have a different scale. Immediately, there's St. Paul's, the church. Right across the street in the 1890s, the St. Paul building. Looks a little like it doesn't know what it wants to do, but that's what it was like in the early days of the skyscraper. In 1899, the Park Row building goes up. The tallest building in the world, not the tallest structure. That is the Eiffel Tower until 1930. It's 1,000 feet, the Eiffel Tower. But the Eiffel Tower is only a metal skeleton. The only thing you have up there is a restaurant. And we know the French are skinny and they eat skinny food, so there's not much to support. But this is a real office building, and you've got to have floor slabs, offices, weight, furniture, people. It had to bear a lot of weight. Go straight up. Still there today, by the way. You can see it from old pictures taken from the Brooklyn Bridge. You see this thing climbing up there and dominating the skyline. 1899, tallest building in the world, today known for JNR. The digital place. I always just call it the JNR building. I'm not sure they say that, but I call it the JNR building. And everybody immediately gets it. Now, this is not New York. It can't be. I mean, the only way you can take a photograph like this is to go out of town. Otherwise, you're going to get killed by a taxi or a bicyclist. So this is, I think this is Salt Lake City. A friend of mine took this many years ago. How did the Beaux-Arts designers treat the skyscraper? The exterior skin, and we're only talking about the exterior skin, the curtain wall, was divided like a neoclassical column into base, shaft, and capital. Narrow base, long shaft, narrow capital. A three-story base, a long middle section known as the shaft, and a decorated capital. Mid-century modernists laughed at this. They thought it was a joke. They came up with the Seagram building and the glass box. Postmodernists of the 1980s brought back this idea. And basically, this is how we deal with skyscrapers today. Why? Because it really does answer the relationship of the skyscraper to the rest of the city. At the lower level, the multi-story base, the decorative base, gives you a streetscape. The very simply designed midsection keeps it from being over-ornamented. And the decorated top is a skyline feature. We can tell the building from miles away. This works beautifully here in New York. Lower Broadway. 1 Broadway, 11 Broadway, 21 Broadway, built over the course of 25 years. Different developers, different architects, different buildings. but they follow the Bashef Capital formula. So as you walk up Broadway, there's a three-story base on each building that relates to the city that's around it. I always say that people walking around New York never look up. These days, they don't even look forward. They look into their phones, but they don't look up. You could have an elephant on the fourth floor, the third floor. Nobody would notice. You could have a family of elephants. Nobody would notice. So you decorate the building where it relates to the pedestrian. You keep the midsection simple so it doesn't get overwhelming. You don't need an excedrin. And then the top of the building, we're going to go across the street, 26 Broadway, the Standard Oil headquarters from 1921 to 1933, Rockefeller. When they built it, look what they did as a capital. I love it, so American. It's Standard Oil. What else would you put on top of it? The Europeans would put some very, you know, well-designed roof, perfectly mansarded or whatever. Not us. We took a giant Roman oil lamp and we stuck it on top of the building, no different than if Campbell's Soup occupied this building and they put a big Campbell's Soup can on top. It's the same thing. It's so American. It was an advertisement for Standard Oil. You can't get better. And remember, people, in those days, a lot of people entered New York by ship. So the first thing you saw was the Statue of Liberty on the left and the Standard Oil oil lamp at the very top of the building on the right. And you would say, that is the Rockefeller building. I mean, we had to be the country that produced Andy Warhol. I mean, you put a Roman oil lamp on top of a huge building and you know, you make this humongous pop art thing on top of the building long before pop art even existed. It's the way Americans think. Why have a big building if you can't use it as a billboard? The skyscraper kept on moving up and up. Chicago stopped at 20 stories, but we kept on going. This is Broad Street looking towards Wall Street about 1905. And look how high the buildings have gone. Just to show you, here is an aerial view from about 1905 with all the skyscrapers hugging Wall Street and Broadway. Up until the 1960s, downtown New York had the same configuration. All the skyscrapers were clustered in the middle of the island. There's Bowling Green. There is 11 Broadway. One Broadway is kind of half built. And 21 will come in the future. This is Battery Park. There is the L train system running through Lower Manhattan, since demolished. The low-rise areas to the right, the South Street area from the 19th century, absolutely intact until 1968, when the city sent in bulldozers and ripped out the entire 19th century district until they got to Fulton Street. And they only stopped because of a huge fight that they had with the preservationists. But all this got ripped out in one fell swoop in 1968. The Washington Market on the left was intact until the late 1960s, ripped out for the World Trade Center and all the urban renewal projects on that side of town. A cheap date in the late 1950s was to take the girls to the Washington Market. It was 1 a.m. The place was packed. Everybody was buying, selling. And we used to walk around after a cheap meal in the village. You'd go down to the Washington Market, and you would have a great time. It was a wonderful city. And you know, you were right in the shadows of the people who made all their money off of the blue-collar work that was going on by the piers. You really saw where your money was coming from. I mean, there was a connection with where your money was coming from. You certainly don't have today when you don't even know what the corporation is that you're investing in, you know, that kind of thing. Look at the cartoons from the early 1910s. New York is going to go up and up and up and up so that one day in the future, besides elevated highways and trains going up the streets, over the street bridges at the 40th floor, if you're a secretary and you're working in this building and you have a friend, Gladys, on the other side of the street, why do you have to go all the way down to the street, go across the street, go all the way up? Just go out to 40th Street, the 40th floor sky bridge. And you notice in 1911 they knew the future was in the sky, but they thought it was all going to be airships, blimps, zeppelins. I don't know if you can read that. One's going to Europe. One's going to the brand new Panama Canal. One is going to Japan, and I love it. One is going to the North Pole. I don't know what they're going there for, except to see Santa Claus, but they're going. And the skyscraper is relentless. Here is a post-Civil War view from Trinity Cemetery. There's the Equitable Life Assurance Building from 1870. In 1895, the block to the south comes down. Up goes 100 Broadway. The American Surety Building is now called 100 Broadway. Bruce Price, who did Tuxedo Park, did a beautiful job. Dominates the skyline, but only for a moment. In 1912, Equitable burns. and they replaced Equitable with, here is 100 Broadway, now dwarfed. And there is 120 Broadway. This is a recent view of the building. It's still there today. A humongous building, goes up 30-odd floors, goes straight up. There's no zoning in New York of those days. This is like the Wild West. You know, it's America. This is my property. I'll do with it what I want. That's why I have the gun on my hip. If you don't like it, I'll shoot you. So the building goes straight up 32 stories, has almost as much office space as the Empire State will have in 1931. You notice it follows the Beaux-Arts idea of base shaft capital, so it's trying to look like a well-behaved building. But did you ever see Fantasia from 1940? You know the segment of the hippos in tutus? This is a hippo in a tutu because it's a humongous building that's trying to pretend it's a beautiful Beaux-Arts building with my base shaft capital formula. New Yorkers were not, they were not impressed. They were really annoyed. There was a huge fight. That, you know, New York, everything's a fight. And in 1916, they passed a zoning code that included setback zoning for the skyscraper, so this would never happen again. What did they base the new setback code on? And by the way, you know where that building is today? Here it is, a wonderful backdrop, neoclassical backdrop to the severe minimalism of the 1968 Skidmore, Owings & Merrill, 140 Broadway, Azama Noguchi's Orange Cube. We don't even notice 120 Broadway. I mean, isn't it interesting? Remember when the World Trade Center was built and it was so out of scale? And it, within 10, 15 years, you hardly even noticed it. It was just kind of there. Well, the 1916 zoning code was based on these two buildings. One is now gone. One is still with us. The Singer Building at Broadway and Liberty. The Woolworth at Broadway by City Hall Park. Here is the Singer on the right. The base of it built in the 1890s. Singer added this tower by Ernest Flagg in 1908. Briefly, it was the tallest building in the world. Beautiful job. I remember this building. I used to go into this building when I'd wander around New York. You know, back then, in the late 50s, you wandered around New York. You needed a bathroom. You walk into an office building, press the elevator button, you go upstairs, and you go find yourself a bathroom. I remember with my friends, I came into Midtown. We went into some office building. We went to the cafeteria at lunchtime. And when they asked us who we were, we said, where were Gladys's kids? Every office had a Gladys. And so we got this free lunch. And we thought we were, you know, absolutely the cat's meow. Anyway, a beautiful building. Of course, that tower was so skinny, it never made much money. The cross bracing alone took up so much space. Here is the lobby of the Singer Building. Some of you may remember it. Beautiful lobby. With terracotta domes, not skylit, but they were electrically lit. There's the Broadway entrance. It had a two-story high shopping mall in the lower parts of it. Really was a beautiful building. But it didn't make much money. It had to come down in the 1960s. What went up, by the way, was one Liberty Plaza. This is the building that replaced the Singer Building. You notice it goes straight up? You can't do that in 1968. So the developer of One Liberty had to buy the block below it, tear it down, put in a plaza. Nobody ever used it except the workers at lunch. They would go out there and have their lunch, and that was it. About 10, 15 years ago, they put a statue of a sitting businessman, a bronze statue of a sitting businessman. Every tourist has to come and take a picture of that. But nobody else bothered with what I called One Liberty Plaza. I didn't know what else to call it. You know, it was kind of nowhere. A few years ago, they renamed it for one of the real estate figures in this city. He used to be the city planning commissioner. I thought, well, he deserves an honor, but I don't know if it's an honor to be have his name as part of a place nobody even knows. Nobody will ever know where it exists. His name, by the way, was John Zuccotti, and this is Zuccotti Park. So you never know what's going to happen in this city, right, from one moment to the next. Well, that building, of course, replacing the Singer, further uptown, Broadway by City Hall Park, the building of all time, the Woolworth Building. I love this building. This was, Roy Suskin is the manager, and he has taken me up to the top of this building. I'm afraid of height. I got to the top of the building. There's a three-story balcony that's all there is. You walk out, there's a three-foot, three-story balcony, and it's 3 feet wide, and the balustrade is up to your waist, and that's it. And you look down, and it's 800 feet to Broadway. And Roy is pointing all this out, and I'm trying to crawl back into the building, trying to figure out how to get out of there. But he's amazing. He was brought up in a sling up the side of the building to check the terracotta. I mean, just telling me that, I almost keeled over. But you know, the guy's fearless. This was a brilliant building, still is. It is the template for the 1920s Art Deco buildings. It gave the City Planning Commission the idea for the 1916 setback zoning code, which produced the 1920s building on the left. You notice how Cass Gilbert, the architect, and F.W. Woolworth, I do have to explain these days, you know that Woolworth's was like a 99-cent store. We called it the 5 and dime, the 5 and 10 cent store. This was its world headquarters, and by the way, it was paid for by F.W. Woolworth out of his pocket. There was no corporation hiding behind a corporation. There's no, you know, poisonous mortgage or something like that. He just paid for it out of his pocket. They decided to set the building back because it was going up to 800 feet. So they did. They set it back to a narrow tower, which was encoded into the zoning code in 1916. It also is the first building to glorify its verticality instead of trying to tamper it down. Again, looking forward to the Art Deco of the 1920s. And it's a city within a building. It is not just an office building. Tourists flocked in to go to the public observation deck, two-story shopping mall, everybody coming in for shopping. People came in for the restaurant, luxury restaurant, for an in-house meal, in-house business meal, business drink. And in 1913, a health club. You think that's a big thing today. The health club is still there. It's closed up, but it's still there. The pool is about the size of the stage, but it's still there. I mean, you could do about 3 laps in it. But it's still there. And by the way, it also had a beautiful connection to the BMT subway, the Broadway subway, the N, the R, I'm not sure of the letters, but you know, the Broadway subway. Here it is from the side. Again, an early photograph. That's Broadway. This is Park Row. There's the St. Paul's building I just showed you. There's the J&R building, the Park Row building. There is the municipal building, brand new in 1915, the old Civil War era post office. That's going to be destroyed in 1938. Should have been destroyed before they built it, but that's the way it was. In fact, you can't even see City Hall. This thing was so humongous, you can see the Tweed Courthouse. There is the Brooklyn Bridge Terminal, which was ripped out in 1948. And by the way, you see the Woolworth Building has a bustle. People don't realize that. It actually has a bustle. It's like duck wings. And there's a light court between the duck wings. And the light court, the light comes down through a skylight and lights up a two-story high shopping mall at the base of this building. So the shopping mall, the tourists going to the observation deck, getting to the subway, shopping itself, going to the restaurant, going to the gym, all of that was accessed by this magnificent two-story high marble-lined, mosaic-tiled, roofed lobby. That is not just a lobby. Think of it as the town square of a vertical city within the building. And everybody, tourist, business person, workout person, someone going to the restaurant, somebody going to the shopping mall. You notice the shopping mall is skylit. More of that in a moment. And if you go into the lobby, which is not so easy these days since 9/11, you'll notice the lobby 2 stories high. There are balconies overlooking the lobby. You could rent the corporate space off those balconies. That balcony was your own private space, and you and your corporate guests could overlook the Woolworth lobby like overlooking an Italian town piazza. And it really is a wonderful space during the day to see people coming and going. By the way, again, this is all a stage set. This is steel framing, just like a Pennsylvania Station's waiting room. But the workmanship is pure 1913, including the mosaic tile ceiling, which is probably done by Italian workers right off the boat who had not heard the English word union. So they were paid nothing, and they created this amazing mosaic tile ceiling. Rip it down, and you can't do this anymore. This you cannot reproduce. So it's an amazing building, but again, it's the pragmatic design of the building. Here's the shopping mall in the rear. I got this off the internet. This is a beautiful photograph, whoever took it. I have to thank him. He'll probably sue me, but anyway. You notice the skylight, originally lit by sunlight because the light comes in through the two wings. Now it's backlit. This was a bank, but it could just as well have been shops. Down on the main floor, look at your shop fronts on the left. That's more my photography there on the left. Your shop fronts, that could be shops as well. Underneath the stair, a beautiful stair taking you down to luxury restaurant, your gymnasium, and the entrance to the BMT subway, which is not there anymore. All of it lit by a beautifully detailed, again, a colored glass skylight. I love the way the Woolworth Building is laid out. I just love to walk through it. I never tire of it. It's kind of like Grand Central Terminal. I never, ever tire of it. Rockefeller Center. I love the way we Americans pragmatically designed this again. A two-story high, a city square almost, an Italian square, an Italian piazza in the form of a skyscraper lobby. Those bridges I mentioned that carry that subsidiary corporate space that you could rent, they are held up. Well, they look like they're held up. This is all a stage set. They're held up by corbels. They're faux corbels. But those corbels are carved, like in a medieval cathedral, they're carved as caricatures of the different people involved in the construction of the Woolworth Building. Now, Roy told me who this was, but I don't know. And he's looking at a stock ticker. So I bet he's the head of Irving Trust, which was the bank that gave them the mortgage and who occupied the second floor of the shopping mall. But the two corbels that everybody photographs, and again, they're all faux. The two corbels they all photograph are Cass Gilbert, the architect. Again, he's holding up one of the bridges. Cass Gilbert, the architect, in the medieval manner, he's holding up his pride and joy, his Woolworth Building that he has designed. And on the right, F.W. Woolworth himself, he's counting his nickels and his dimes. And that is the beauty of the Beaux-Arts era, you know? They could give us transportation complexes, skyscrapers, amazing glass box department stores, and yet they could have fun. Trouble with modern design, it does not have fun. I wish they could just smile once in a while, do a Groucho Marx, but it does not. The result was, by the 1910s, we are the first skyscraper city in the world. Today, you can go to Dubai, you can go to Singapore, they all have skyscrapers. Not then. Here is a view, again, the balloon, 1905. This is in Roy Salonen's office, and I'll tell you why in a moment. Here it is up close. This photograph was taken in 1931-32, and the reason was, it's in the manager's office of the Woolworth Building, and the reason why they took it, and by the way, it's very much as it would have been in 1915, except for the 1923 telephone building damaged in 9/11, but repaired. Another building, you might notice, Cass Gilbert's 90 West Street, gorgeous building, damaged in 9/11, now repaired. There's the Singer Building. These buildings are the Hudson II buildings that were taken down for the World Trade Center in the 1960s. And there is the building built in the 1920s following the zoning code, that the template for which was the Woolworth Building. Now, why did they take this photograph? The Woolworth goes up in 1913. The outside terracotta is pure white. By 1931, it's pure black. That was how dirty the air was in New York back then. You go to China, you complain about the pollution. You should go in a time machine to New York in 1905 if you want pollution. This was absolutely soot black by 1931. So what did they do? They cleaned it from head to foot. They cleaned the whole building. They were proud of how beautiful and clean and white it was. So they hired a photographer to take a skyline view of the newly cleaned Woolworth Building, only 20 years after it had been built. Anyway, here is the skyline of the city. I know it's not spectacular to you guys, but if you were coming in from anywhere in the world, and you were coming by boat, most likely, and you pulled into the harbor, and the Statue of Liberty is on the left, and the bridges are off there on the right, the Brooklyn Bridge, this was the skyline you saw. It was the first skyline city in the world. When I went to Berkeley in 1962, my fellow students were all from little California towns, and I'll never forget, one of them said to me, "What is it like to be on the 50th floor?" Because he had never been in a building above two or three stories. And I grew up, my aunt worked in the Empire State. She was on the 85th floor, so I was just used to all that. Here is the first real skyline city in the world, done under the aegis of the Beaux-Arts. There is the Singer Building. There is the Woolworth Building, there is the Municipal Building. There is, again, a Battery Park, the old aquarium, which Robert Moses sent packing to Brooklyn. Your East River is on the right, the Hudson River is on the left. Remember, in those days and right through the 1950s and 60s, these were working riverfronts. And they had factories, stevedores, longshoremen. You could walk from Wall Street, where everybody was white collar, and in 5 minutes you were on the piers and everybody was blue collar. It was an intense city. It was the city of my youth. I walked around the city and I loved it. And it really, I always tried to think what it's like to enter New York if you didn't grow up here, what it was like to come into the city for the first time. This was the city, by the way, that German Expressionist director Fritz Lang visited in 1921. He went back to Germany, and with this vision of a skyscraper city, he created the silent screen classic Metropolis, which he based on this skyline, but through his German Expressionist eyes. Really is quite extraordinary, the city of the early 20th century. This Beaux-Arts period gave us public buildings, entertainment complexes, amazing transportation complexes, services like the New York Public Library, and the first skyline city in the world. When we come back next week, we're going to see how people lived in New York from the mansions of the city, the row houses of the city, but more importantly, the new way the middle class is going to live in New York, the apartment house, next week. I'll see you next week.